and House Committee on Transportation. It's Monday, May the 5th. We have an agenda, but please, audience, bear with us. We're going to be bouncing around quite a bit today, people coming and going. For instance, we need 7 to do our first item, and there's only 6 of us here, so we will go on to the next item, which is Senate Bill 108, and we will have a public hearing on 108. We'll open a public hearing on 108, Senate Bill 108.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 108 is a bill sponsored by the Senate Interim Committee on Transportation and General Government. It would create the Oregon Department, an Oregon Department of Aviation, with a 5-member state aviation board. Would take effect July 1st in the year 2000. The bill is fairly long, because of the replacement of the Department of Transportation and a number of statutes with the Department of Aviation. The bill does transfer all the duties and functions of the Department of Transportation that relate to aviation to the new department, with the exception of 2 items that the Department of Transportation would maintain the function. And you can see that in Section 7 of the bill, that the Department of Transportation will maintain duties that are related to collection of aircraft fuel taxes, and will transfer those to the Aviation Department. And the other area that stays with the Department of Transportation is in Section 28, where the Department of Transportation and the Transportation Commission approve the methodology for transferring motor vehicle fuel to the Department of Aviation. Again, otherwise, Mr. Chair and members, all other duties and functions are transferred to the new Department of Aviation. And to point out that the director of the Department of Aviation is required to be a pilot under the measure and to have experience in managing airports. The Aviation Board would be appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation, and the director of the new department would be appointed by the and serve at the pleasure of the board and not at the pleasure of the governor.
I was just questioning in terms of the requirements that the director be a pilot. Do you have any current certification, or have at one point in your life held a pilot's license, so that if for some medical reason someone lost the ability to fly, they would then automatically have to be removed as director? I'm just curious in terms of how extensive the requirements are.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hill, the requirements on lines 19 and 20 of page 2, the board may not appoint a person as director unless the person has a pilot's license and has experience in airport operations or management. Maybe someone from the department could answer.
Let's explain the bill, and then we'll get into questions and answers later. Let's explain the bill, and then we'll have the people come forward, and that's when we ask the questions. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal, and the staff measure summary from the Senate committee is at your place. And I think that's all I was going to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we start testifying on it, I think it's best before the audience starts coming forward, there's 2 or 3 little amendments I understand we have. That way everybody understands what we're talking about. We all come to testify about a bill, and then we have some amendments. And then we got a new bill. I don't see any big changes. There is some. I think Representative Hill has made some excellent observations. And Representative Lehman had a couple here that he wanted to talk about. Let's talk about the amendments, if that's okay with the audience. Then you'll know what we're talking about as a committee, and the committee will know what we're thinking about. Representative Lehman, do you have a couple? And then Representative Hill.
I've got one that I know has issue been raised by a group of others at the department. The new department shall not have established rules affecting land use. I think that's one of the things we ought to make sure that it's not there, because we've run into problems with that already with ODOT, and I think creating that with another department out there during land use, if they want to make land use recommendations to LCDC, they should be able to. And the other one that I have kind of related to Representative Hill is that we just changed ODOT so that the director would feel it operates at the control and direction of the governor. I think this department also ought to operate at the control and direction of the governor, not at the discretion of the board or the director of this department.
Well, that would be it for sure. That doesn't state it that way then, does it?
No, I think it doesn't.
Well, then that would have to be an amendment. So that was an assumption on my part that it was correct. Those are some of the conceptual amendments that the committee is thinking about, so the audience knows what we're thinking about. But I absolutely think what did you have serve as the director of the governor is a must, or it won't get out of committee. So let's move ahead with the testing. And I apologize to the audience. We had this scheduled for the 26th and didn't get to it. You have a sign-up sheet from that date. I think it's only fair that we start with the list from there. And that's with someone who has a meeting they must go to. We'll just start right down the list. The first on the list on the 26th, if we're here, is Chuck Bennett and John Helm, I believe, Oregon Aviation Coalition. If that's okay with the audience, I think that's only fair.
Yeah.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for being here. I'm sorry for the delay, but we were hard at work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing us again. Mr. Chairman, I'm joined by Paul Meyerhoff. Mr. Helm was unable to be here today. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Oregon Aviation Coalition. We were given the opportunity, myself and Mr. Meyerhoff, to testify at the last hearing, and I'll just take this opportunity. Didn't have a chance to answer any questions. Wanted to just very briefly underscore again that I provided you in my written testimony with a copy of the fiscal impact statement, which has not changed. And from hearing the amendments that are being proposed by the committee and by others that I'm aware of, which appear to be certainly friendly amendments to us, would not change that fiscal impact statement. And we have relied heavily on that as a description of how this new configuration of aviation as a separate department would result in a better use of aviation fuel taxes, jet fuel taxes, as well as pilot registration fees, because it results in a net savings for the department. And really, Mr. Chairman, that I would think that's enough for me. Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Bennett? Thank you. Yes, sir. Did you have any comments?
Yes, Chairman Montgomery, members of the committee. My name is Paul Meyerhoff. I'm Director of Corporate Development with the TAPA Group in Eugene, New York, and Flagstaff, which is the I mentioned that before, but the largest fixed-base operator of aircraft within the gas station, basically, in the state of Oregon for pilots and aircraft owners. There was one thing that I wanted to add in addition to the testimony that I provided last time. And that is, I just want to give you a vision of how important airports are to the state of Oregon. Sun River, the airport that exists there, has been an absolute essential component to the development of Central Oregon, the Bend-Redmond area. Many of the entrepreneurs who now reside in Central Oregon and have very successful businesses there were introduced to Central Oregon through Sun River and through their flying in there in private or corporate aircraft, through vacationing there, through playing golf there, through skiing there, through recreation. Sun River has been a very, very key component to the development of the Central Oregon area. Today, you have a new development in Bandon. You have an area there that economically has been depressed on the coast, an area that's just looking for an opportunity to grow, looking for an opportunity to become something different than they've been for many years. And now you have what comes along Bandon Dunes, a golf course that is receiving accolades throughout the United States, indeed throughout the world, in the golf press. There is an airport in Bandon. It's operated by the state, small airport. That airport is going to become key to that community as people begin to fly in to Bandon, play golf and learn more about the coast and the opportunities that exist on the coast. And I can tell you that my experience in airports, which goes back 20 years, says that these airports are economic development tools for the communities in which they exist. They aren't just little airports. They are economic development tools. and Bandon will be important for that community, and the airport there will be essential as that community grows and develops. And as people come in and see how cool the coast is in Oregon. And I think that's just the small message I wanted to leave with you, is it's not just airports aren't, as some people believe, playgrounds of the rich. That isn't what they are. 80% of the airports, 80% of the usage of airports is business. And the rural airport system in the state, whether you call an airport in Astoria or in Danville, rural, the airports outside of the major air service airports are essential for those communities to grow and develop, whether it's light business or whatever. And that, in part, is one of the reasons why the Associated Oregon Industries has an official position that the establishment of the Department of Aviation should occur. So with that, I'd be pleased to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, Mr. Green.
Chairman, do you have any problems? You're the amendments we're talking about. One would be the new director would respond to the governor, not the committee. Are you okay with that?
Yes, I don't believe we have any problems.
Okay. Yes,
and related to a pilot's license, by the way, Chair Representative Lean, once you receive a pilot's license, you have it for life. There are currency requirements, but they don't relate to the wording in the bill. So once you have that license, you never lose it.
But overall, would you have any objections to pulling that language out of the requirements? And I think that's a fairly unique, very few job descriptions I've seen that they have requirements that you, if you find a top-notch director that really understands the business, I'm not sure you'd want to not be able to hire him just because he didn't have a pilot's license.
Mr. Chairman,
for her.
Right now it is her. Mr. Chairman, I you make a very good case, Representative Lehman. The current, the interim director, I believe, does not have a pilot's license, but has a superb background in airport management. And I think you make it's certainly a policy issue for this body. There are some things about airports that a licensed pilot is going to understand probably better than anyone else, and that it's a very helpful thing to understand what you're up against as a pilot from the air coming in, and I'm sure Representative Krupp or other pilots here could speak to that much better than I can as a ground.
By not putting it in, your board could still have that as one of their criteria.
They certainly could.
But if we put it in, you got to do it.
Right, and in fact, this was in old, I believe it was last session or the session before, the ODOT director was required to be a pilot, which was a vestige of an older batch of language that existed that was really pretty archaic at the time.
Thank you. One follow-up.
And third one, the part about taking you out of a land use process, and to be honest with you, it may be save you more than anything else of not getting into that mix, and I think the director of Department of Transportation would tell you that it may save you a lot by not being in that mix. Do you have any problems with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, the department, the Department of Aviation, today the Aviation and Aeronautics Unit, does serve a function in land use. If someone wants to build a school in the flight path of an airport, that's a significant issue. If someone wants to build a freeway, as was suggested in Redmond and planned in Redmond through the airport protection zone, that is an issue. So as long as I think that the department is not removed from the opportunity to at least comment on it.
Thank you very much. I understand that the clinic has to be in revenue shortly. Would you like to come forward now? I know you have to be 2 or 3 places at once. Sorry about that. Thanks for being here.
Chairman, could you also show us your pilot's license?
I'm just flying around right now. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Grace Connick, and Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here in opposition to this bill. In 1973, the legislature pulled a miscellaneous assortment of transportation agencies together and told them to start thinking intermodally and start thinking about their impact on each other. In 1993, some other changes were made where critical areas of concern were identified, and the director was given the ability to move the agencies around in terms of the organizational structure and the assignment of work. And then in 1995, I believe the legislature added to our functions some transfers from the PUC, which were motor carrier and rail. I came on in 96. The two uses of that 93 authority I've utilized were to consolidate in our central services function human resources, the information systems, the budget, folks all under one, and I appointed Mike Marsh, the head of that outfit, called it Central Services. The other was to take from what was the Transportation Development Branch, four modes, called aeronautics, public transit, railroads, and the transportation safety functions, and give them division status again, and I think that is appropriate. What division status means in ODOT is that they have a direct connection to the director on policy issues and administrative issues. Two is that they have a direct representation to what we call the transportation policy and operations team, which is where the transportation operations questions get answered and policy issues get set. It also provided the modes more visibility in the budget so that you could open the budget up, find the particular programs. We had that problem in the 1997 session. It also has provided for more direct representation to the legislature by the modes. They make their own presentations on the budget. Ann's with me here today on policy issues. And for me, it meant more direct contact with the constituents that are out there. Mr. Chairman, we're here to tell you that we're working very closely together. I understand that there have been problems in the past. We've tried to address those problems. I sat down with the Aviation Advisory Committee about a year and a half ago, and then again, we have a commissioner that's charged with working with that agency. Recently, we've set some priorities. I put it to the advisory committee to stop complaining and start getting me some to-do lists, and we get to doing. And the three items that they came up with were to adopt the land use standards, which the commission has done in March, implementing from last session, House Bill 2605. They asked us to work hard on getting other funding for aviation, for the airports, trying to get, and the package has resulted, trying to get our runways in shape this session. And the third area was to preserve and develop air service and to improve the economic ties to the community, which we're working on. The aeronautics section, I think, has done a good job under Ann's leadership. We've got the aviation plan under development. A lot of credit goes to Ron Larson from SOAR. He's done a great job heading that group. And as I said, the commission has already adopted the rules. My job is to make sure that Aero and all the modes plan and play their appropriate roles in this integrated transportation system and work together. Our focus for the coming years is to develop sources of funding and maintain an airport system. We expect to do that. We want to protect the airports through the land use process, trying to make sure that they have a healthy future. We think that airports are, and the whole aeronautics system is critical to Oregon's future. And to educate local governments and communities as to the vital role that airports play. We have a statewide system to maintain and to participate in. Not all of the major airports do we have direct responsibility for, but we do coordinate with them. So I'm here today to tell you that we are working together. We have an integrated system, and I think it would not be good public policy to turn the pages back in history and start peeling off. The sponsors of this bill initially told me that this was the beginning and ODOT ought to be dissembled. We have a bill to dismember ODOT over in the other body, and I think this is the beginning. I don't think it's good for aeronautics, and I don't think it's good for transportation in general. Thank you.
Grace, one of the things that's come up is that there is some indication that the administrative charges from ODOT are higher than what the aviation department would have if they went through DAS. Can you explain why that is, or is there any justification?
Mr. Chairman, the issue, that issue's been before us for some time. It's a great frustration to me that we didn't reach resolution. So I got John Yunker and Mike Marsh in the same room. And they are reaching agreement. Either we'll be able to charge the DAS rates, whatever they are. I think it's a very legitimate point and concern, and they are not as the Aviation Advisory Committee raised it to us. In part, the reason is because we get charged as an agency overhead rates from gas, which are part of our central services, and then reallocate those costs out to all of the modes. And in doing so, they end up paying for gas as services and ODOT services in the allocation. DAS has a bit of a break for small agencies, and DAS also, I think when the fiscal was put together, hadn't updated their rates, and they have some new updated rates, which will reduce the difference between what we charge. We have done the calculation in advance, what we charge and what DAS charges. So I think either in ODOT we will eliminate, walk through and eliminate something that will parallel DAS, or if we cannot do that legally because we don't want other funds to pick up what should properly belong to aeronautics, then we'll reach some agreement with DAS that we can somehow charge them the DAS rate. I agree there should not be a difference as to where you're housed.
One last question, Grace. What are the advantages that an aviation division gets out of being involved with ODOT as compared to being standalone? Is there any big advantages, either federal or state, that are gained by being there?
I think so. I think you've got the coordination already in-house. Part of the work of the community solutions team the governor's had is to take directors like myself from economic development, housing, DEQ, and bring us together, because the day-to-day work doesn't necessarily integrate those programs. By having aeronautics housed in DOT, that integration takes place on a bi-monthly basis. Sitting down at our table. So you've got the planned integration of the programs. In addition to that, I think that the partnerships that can happen are much more likely to happen in some of the benefits reached. Ann has done a good job in going through and trying to figure out how to make sure that the maintenance costs and the market rates are charged at airports. In doing that, he's got access to ODOT to see if we're going to be out more in the lawn someplace. Can we give them a cheaper rate than she can get someplace else? So I think that the coordination is there. In addition, a lot of the work in transportation has to do with coordination with local governments. And I think, as we found when we went through this last land use responsibility, which is the first really direct responsibility I think the commission's had in the land use area, and we'd like to thank you for that opportunity from the last session. But in doing so, I think we found that in working with cities and counties, they were more responsive to what aeronautics was concerned about, because they had to deal with ODOT on a number of issues and understood that we were looking at the total system. And I think they listened a little bit more carefully to what was being said and had a little bit more muscle on their side of the discussion.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I guess further on this question of the notion that it's going to save money. I guess I'm trying to understand. Today, we're just going to be stuck with, we'll keep the same desks, we'll stay where they are today. But then I see, we have to strike out our own identity. The next thing is, we're going to want our own facility. So they're going to go out here in Salem somewhere and rent a building and slap up a Department of Aviation, sign on the outside of it so they have their own identity. And that's going to cost a little bit more than it would be to stay in a state facility. I'm concerned that, we could go do this for every agency. We look at human resources. Well, we could break up all those divisions, and suddenly at the end of the day, we're going to save money. I think history tells us that it doesn't, because there's a reason why we consolidated in the past. So I'm a little bit concerned about, this notion where we're going to suddenly save money. I mean, if there's an efficiency that can be found in terms of how we do accounting, well, that's great. Let's take the efficiency and roll those dollars back in. But I don't see any lack of focus on the aviation issues. So I guess I'm tending to agree that this is unnecessary. Somebody can tell me that, what opportunities have been lost because of the integration of the aviation division within ODOT. And that I guess is sort of what's the compelling interest is what I'm interested in. I guess maybe that's the question, Grace. Do you know of opportunities that have been lost because of the integration in Department of Transportation? Have you learned something through this process of how you should deal with them differently
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I would like to correct a little bit of the perception problem you have on the separation of aeronautics. Currently has their own building. They're housed out at the Salem Airport. These are not great facilities, so we've got some money in the capital budget to try and it comes out of aeronautics fees to try and upgrade. If you've been out there, it's just not a deluxe plush carpet establishment. It's very crafty in the winter. And I think that the issue, if I understand in talking with the aeronautics folks, I think if you said that the fiscal showed that it would cost them $25,000, it would remove an argument that they have in coming forward and asking for your approval here because they can show some technical savings. It's probably, going to be below, $100,000, but which is real money. I think the thing to keep in mind is that on the money issue, every dollar we save, money is important. I don't mean to mean money is important, especially for this agency. It's a small agency. Every dollar counts. And I think the pilots particularly are concerned that their dollars are not, they don't want their dollars to go to overhead. Who does? I agree with them. I hate that part of it. And it's been a thorn in my side all this time. What I think they would also say they've lost in addition to the dollars, and I still think they'd be at the table if we told them there was going to be a $25,000 cost. Probably not much more than that, but I think what they think they've lost is their ability to advocate. And I don't think that's the case. I've heard one story about something that's happened during my administration here, which had to do with Congress and ODOT advocating for aeronautics. I've heard other facts and were communicated to one representative who talked to me about that. And we've done our best to advocate for aeronautics. I think they want their own thing. I think they want to be able to advocate for whatever else they want. I think they'll find when they do it, they're going to run into the governor's office or economic development or wherever you put them, that they have not wanted their wings clipped, so to speak, in the past. They've wanted to advocate for whatever they wanted here without coordination with other folks. And I think if you set up your own agency, you quickly run into the governor who has his own opinions about things and for whom we work. And that's been kind of hard for some of them to understand. This is not the pilot's club or the airplane owner's club. This is a state agency that has some responsibilities to manage airports. That's been hard for some people. Others understand it completely. And this is it's the advocacy part of it. And so when advocacy comes into play and they think we're not at 110% of where we should be, we may have had to fit into the state government role. We're government employees and not quite been out there as much. We did get our wings flapped a little bit by the chairman, which is appropriate, and we're sorry for that. We lost some communication here earlier. But I think generally speaking, it's a very well-run outfit. And they advocate greatly for aeronautics. I'm trying to do more of that. We've had this little discussion underway, so it's been a little bit tough. It's the same problem with the truckers. That's part of life. That's why I get all the big bucks, I guess. But I'm a big supporter of and promoter of aeronautics. And I think, if anything, I've become more familiar with the issues that they have.
Thank you.
More than I should have said, I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grace, in Mr. Meyerhoff's written testimony, he, at the beginning of the end of the first page, he talks about over the past 6 years, and I quote, the department has removed six people, the department meaning Oregon Department of Transportation, from the agency and moved them to other state positions. Is that true, and if so, why?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cup, I don't know what the past, what the history was in terms of the FTE. I know that they've got the FTE now that they can sustain given the fees they have. Over time, since Mr. Meyerhoff has left, over time the money hasn't gone up, but people's salaries have as time goes on. And so I at one point offered them back an FTE, and they really couldn't use it at that point in time from another part of the agency. They really couldn't use it at that time because they didn't have the money to staff up. So I think when ODOT went through a consolidation, we may have taken some administrative people away, but I think right now they're sustaining what they can afford. I would also say at one point in time, they ran out of money and they had to close them down. for a 6 month period the decision was made. And that was just before they brought on Betsy Johnson, and she had to come in and, you know, kind of straighten things out a little bit. So I think they're living within their means, and we're trying very hard to put the money out on the pavement, in this case, on the runway improvements as best we can. So I don't think there's an issue there. I could, Ann?
So you don't know why the six people were moved to from Aeronautics to ODOT?
The only general concern I heard when talking to everyone is that we did an administrative consolidation again before I got there, where central services were provided. That was a rub for everybody. And I think that they, you know, if you say your budget analyst is 2 miles down the street, then me failing too. And so we've been trying to get a central service. But I think that, but that only explains one position. The rest of them, I don't have a clue. And what I'm saying is, in part, they're living within their means, so that we're all, you know, getting squeezed out in that sense. The salaries are going up, they're not adding FTE for the most part.
Mr. Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cunningham, you know, I've told you very straightforwardly that if the bill gets to the committee and if the chair brings it to work session, then I'll support the bill. I did want to give some comments on the record from you about a couple of areas. One, well, I think that transportation and land use would be very coordinated. I'm not going to advocate that DLTD be merged into the transportation department. One of the basic problems that I've heard from people, and I've heard from a lot of pilots actually in my district, I seem to have a lot of pilots in my district, is that they feel that, you know, somehow a small department, the aviation division, you know, whatever it's going to ultimately be, 16, 17 people, gets lost in a department of almost 5,000 people. What's your response to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, when I had talked to everyone and made the conversion from being a part of the Transportation Development Division into being division, one of the things that was said by Transit, Aero, Railroads, and Safety was that they want to be like DMV. They wanted to have as much access as DMV. I don't think they wanted the computer problems of DMV, but they wanted the access. They now have the access. They meet with me as often as DMV meets with me. I meet with Jan Curry. We have a once-a-month meeting to handle substantive issues. Just wholly dedicated to DMV. Twice a month we meet in an administrative meeting. I meet twice, once a month with Ann. On the substance of just aeronautics, and I meet twice a month with Ann at the transportation policy and operations meeting. And then they all have access to me for phone calls, miscellaneous stuff that goes on when things are happening. Ann and I have met a bunch. I think that they have every piece of time and access that DMV does. So I don't think that they get lost at all. If anything, we're straightening a couple things out. We needed a good aeronautics plan, something that we could bank on and move forward with. We needed to clear out some of the accusations that were being made. I think we cleared a lot of that stuff out. This is not a perfect situation. I'm not here saying we're so perfect we'd like you to come in and, you know, use us as a model anyplace. But I think we've got a good relationship there, and I certainly take to heart and have had good conversations with the advocates that sit on our Aviation Advisory Committee. So I think if you talk to Jan Curry and Ann and ask them about access, time, and issues, they don't have the money DMV has, but we're trying to work on that, too. And I know there's been some talk about let's hold this bill hostage to the money bill. I'm not in that. I mean, I'm for it, whether they report to me or not. By the way, I would like to tell you what I told Ways and Means, Mr. Chairman. Currently, we have running through our budget about $600 million worth of money that we don't touch. But I'm constantly reminded of in the other body. And if you're going to remove aeronautics from us, and if we don't have any relation, I mean, if it's a big enough issue to remove the policy function, I think it's a big enough issue to remove the revenue function. And I'm requesting of Ways and Means that they take that out so that I no longer am, if you're not going to hold me accountable for aeronautics, that you not hold me accountable. Having said that, I will tell you that the most cost-efficient way to collect that money is to stay with ODOT. I also think the most beneficial policy thing to do is to keep it with ODOT, but just so that you know.
Well, thank you, Grace. We have about 5 or 6 more people to sign up. For the benefit of the committee, we also have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 House bills that I would sure like to hear and make a decision on today, because if we don't, they're dead. And this is being a nonpartisan committee. I think 2 are Republican bills and 2 are Democrat bills, so we're not trying to save anybody's bacon. Thank you very much. We have a staff person around in case you have some questions. I hope about it. Thank you. Rather than try to juggle these lists from the 26th and the 5th, the committee will bear, the audience will bear with us. We're just going to start down the list and not try, we won't leave anybody out. Next on our list on the sign-up sheet today was Ted Miller. Thank you, sir, for being here. And anybody you have with you, you're welcome to bring forward.
Thank you. My name is Ted Millar.
Millar.
I'm part of the Aviation Advisory Committee. Ron Larson, who is the chairman, is unable to be here this morning, so I just came to speak for him. We're a statutory committee that's appointed by the Transportation Commission to advise and provide citizen input and user input and oversight to the Aeronautics Division. Our committee is represented by myself. I'm a businessman in Portland and a pilot. I have several aircraft. Ron Larson, who's represents the Port of Astoria. Norm Winningstead, who is the Central Coast airport operator at the Newport. Mike Boggs is the manager of the Eugene Airport. Bill Griffiths is Portland General Electric. And Judge Laura Pryor is the county court person from Gillum County. The advisory committee has reviewed this issue in detail for the last 2 or 3 years. We've been very frustrated with some of the process, of course. And we strongly support this bill. We think it's the very best for aeronautics. I could go on into some of the details. I'm sure you've heard a lot of them, and there's others.
Maybe you can help us out. You've heard some of the concerns of the committee representing Bill's concern, representing Lena's concern. As a member of the advisory committee, you see any problem with those suggestions being added to the bill, i.e. that it doesn't necessarily have to be a pilot to be the director, and the land use issue that could be brought up and appointed towards the direction of the governor. I think those are the 3 things we talked about. So those.
I don't see a problem with the governor, although I would sure encourage him to work closely with the overall Transportation Commission and the advisory committees for input. As far as the pilot situation goes, I think it's a very helpful thing to have that person be a pilot, because we have to deal with the federal status, and it's a lot bigger picture than just the state of Oregon. You don't have to have a current medical to still maintain your pilot's license. At least you've gone through that training.
And you understand the difference is by putting it in the statute as being a pilot, and you have no other choice. If it's not in the statute, you can certainly put those requirements on, but
yeah,
it's not set by law.
And I agree with that. I think if the criteria is set up correctly, it can still have the same effect.
Everything will.
And as far as land use planning, I think it's very critical that aeronautics is part of the land use planning process. Just because we need to protect airports from infringement by noise sensitive uses that shouldn't really be there. So I think it's just important that they have a say in the process someplace.
Thank you. This advisory committee was set up as an advisory committee within ODOT, and what happens to this advisory committee during this change? Because as I see in the board, we create a state aviation board. Will this advisory committee be eligible evidently for that board, or what's going to happen to this committee? And this, as I understand, there is a committee that was set up under ODOT structure, or it was prior to ODOT.
This whole thing?
Because we do have a state highway commission, what part do they play, and what is your relationship to those people?
Can I be excused for this one? I think I'm getting sick, but we were their part. We had an advisory committee before ODOT, and we've been part of ODOT, and I'm not sure how we'd be in the new setup. I assume we would be.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming forward, sir. We appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
We have Tom Mann with us. Tom, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Mann. I represent Lone Star Northwest, your favorite aggregate producer. I've met with each one of you personally. We have a small, little, tiny little amendment we'd like to propose to you today. It does not affect the bill in any way, really. It's just in the issue a couple little minor things that potentially affect my client. I should say we've worked with the sponsors of this bill, and we consider this friendly. They testified at the last meeting at the 26th that they were okay with this. And I'd like to say on the record that we sure appreciate their help with allowing us to, amend their bill. That being said, we address on page 6 issues dealing with water impoundments. As you may know, a mining operation that digs a hole in the ground occasionally creates a water impoundment. Last session, there was a House Bill 2605, which identified and dealt with airport rules, how airports get along with their neighbors. And this bill identified a process through local government where we deal with water impoundments. And what we ask for in this amendment is two prongs. First is that this new Department of Aviation, should the committee and should the legislature pass this bill, that they have to abide by the current ORS 836 on water impoundments. I was asked in the Senate why I wanted that, and I said, well, first of all, we're a little paranoid, and secondly, we've seen agencies through their administrative rule writing process not necessarily abide by the intent or the letter of the law. And as Representative Lehman has indicated, there's some land use issues. We're very comfortable with what's in the current statute, and we'd just like that inputted into any authorizing language on a new development of a Department of Aviation. The second piece of this, which is, we believe, also fairly simple, currently the department can create or define a hazard. And when I testified in the Senate, we said, you know, hazard, we're all for that. They should be able to define a hazard. But there should be some process using fact-finding and substantial evidence in defining a hazard instead of just saying, well, that's a hazard. And we say, well, no, it's not. And they say, well, yes, it is. And we have this argument. And in 2605, in the current language in 836, fact-finding and substantial evidence is the language that was used last session that the legislature passed. And what we're asking for in the second part of this amendment is that language be applied in this bill as well, defining hazards. And that's all we have. So we're hoping that you can consider this amendment and approve it, put it part of the bill, should you decide to pass this legislation.
Thank you, Tom. We only have a copy of the amendment, and we'll talk about that in work session then.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Next on our list is Mike Van Umessen. Mike, thank you for being here, Oregon Aviation Alliance. And then we have two others to testify, and that's it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Van Umessen of Lake Oswego. I'm president here today representing the Oregon Aviation Alliance. The Alliance is a collection of member organizations which are the users of the Oregon aviation system. Some of our members include the Oregon Pilots Association. We have some 8,000 pilots represented throughout our organization, the Civil Air Patrol, the Oregon Agricultural Aviation Association, the Port of Portland is among us. Oregon Aeronautics Division has a seat at our table, and the Oregon Airport Management Association also is a member organization. We have some 20 organizations which represent the users of the Oregon aviation system. With the exception of perhaps maybe two of our member organizations that are neutral, we strongly support this bill, and we don't have any objection to the amendments and changes that you've discussed here so far this morning. Our overwhelming majority of our members are all for the efficient planning and development of our Oregon State Aviation System. We have to have efficient operation of the state aviation system, and we believe that this bill will do that. We have great respect for Grace Krenikin, and but the fact remains that although she may wish these changes have occurred and wish that they will occur in the future, these changes that she discussed to give aviation a greater voice, the fact remains and the history proves. And I think Deputy Johnson could give you lots of particulars, and I hope she'll follow me. The fact remains that aviation has always come last in ODOT, ODOT is a huge organization, and it just doesn't have the time and energy to give aviation the voice and the fiscal budget that it needs in order to properly serve the Oregon State Aviation System.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. How is rolling this out to its own agency going to give this more money?
Well, first of all, we've removed that administrative surcharge, we believe, that we're being faced with. We'll have control of our, the agency would have control of its own budget. And more importantly than that is it would have the ability to raise issues and manage the state aviation system without having to surface those issues from the bottom of the ocean all the way up to the top of ODOT, which is a bureaucratic problem and a nightmare. In our view, we wouldn't have the staff at ODOT going to meetings all the time at which they're not on the agenda, they're just going to meetings, and they could work on the things that the aviation system needs to be worked on. It would be more efficient. I liken it to spinning off a AT&T spinning off Lucid so that a arm of the corporation can work more efficiently with its own staff and money.
Yes, we'll have just we're going to go to 9:15 on this bill. Then we're going to the other bills, regardless of where we are on this bill. And I don't care how far anybody's driven to get here, we won't get to them because of 9:15 punctual. At this point, we have about 5 amendments. My question right now to Janet is, can we have these ready Friday morning? First item on our agenda to have the amendments for Senate Bill 108 so we can do our thing with it. There's no way we can conceptually amend this bill now with all the tin scraps on all these bills. Is that possible for Friday morning?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. For the benefit of the audience, we'll move on to 9:15. The gavel goes down and we get our colleagues' other bills. And thank you, sir, for being here. Did you have more comments? Representative Lehman, you know the ground rules. And the rest of the hill. Or the other way around, you were talking. Pardon me, Hill.
I guess I'm still at a loss for what is something tangible that will come out as a result of this. You talked about less meetings, we'll be focused on the issues. We had a previous bill before this committee that basically said, you know, the money that's being collected, you know, isn't enough to maintain runway, so we need to put more dollars on the runway in terms of are we going to have the director out, doing a pavement overlay crew or something because they have more focus on this. I mean, everybody's talked about pronouns. There's nothing specific. What is the noun that is going to be a tangible result of moving this out on its own?
The tangible result is that the director of the department would be able to voice the problems with the aviation system without having to get permission from the director of ODOT. I think in a nutshell, that's it.
Who is the director going to voice their concerns to?
To this body, to the public, to the aviation system users, to the Federal Aviation Administration. We want to unmuzzle the director of the aviation department.
Thank you, Representative Lehman.
One quick question, One is that if, in fact, we spin out this agency, one way or the other, they're going to be answering to the governor.
Absolutely.
Could you describe to me how you think the governor has more time for aviation, given everything that he or she is doing, as compared to the Department of Transportation?
I don't think it's a function of the governor having more time for aviation. I think it's the question of whether the governor ever sees the aviation position, because the position's been squelched or sequestered at the bottom of the ODOT organization.
One final question, and we're moving on. Sorry, committee.
Does the governor want this new responsibility or not?
I'm not sure the governor. I don't know. I haven't asked the governor.
Thank you. Next on, thank you, sir, for being here. Next on, Leslie Johnson. She's been very patiently waiting. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. And if you have someone with you, is that Paul Meyer?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Meyerhoff is joining me simply because we represent together the last 10 years of management of the Aeronautics Division. I want to correct some things that Ms. Krunikin said. I want to start by making absolutely clear, and I think we've shared with all of you individually as my colleagues and I have been around to visit, that this is not an ODOT bashing bill. This is not part of a program to dismantle ODOT. And I think that Ms. Krunikin may have left you with the opinion that at some point in time, some of us that are proponents of this bill had suggested to her that the contrary. I say as clearly as I can that is not the case. This bill was here in the 1997 session. It's back again with even more support. Ms. Krunikin may have left the impression that the Department of the Aeronautics is a creation of a 1973 piece of legislation. That's not the case. This is a state agency that goes back to 1921. It predates the FAA by 7 years. It has had a board for all that time that reflects the users who pay for it. And consequently, those users have taken a keen interest in how the agency functions, how they spend their money. Their very modest little building out at the airport purchased by user fees in 1955, where Aero would stay, quite happily. So I want to make absolutely clear that this is not a let's dismantle ODOT bill.
Mr. Chairman, Betsy, would you agree with Grace's assessment that if you take away my direction and control of this agency and take away my financial responsibilities all, even though that's probably going to cost more to collect that someplace else?
Actually, that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lane, that issue had quite a substantive discussion in Ways and Means. It's interesting that back in the fiscal impact statement for the 1997 legislature, ODOT agreed to continue that. Grace used the word accountability. It's not an accountability. It's a tax collection function. The methodology is all in place. The people are all in place. It's a fee for service that Aeronautics pays for. And I might add that the cost went up exponentially. The cost accelerated times three just before I left the agency. But it's a fee for service, and there really is no accountability. It's simply a collection function. It makes sense to leave it there. They collect fees for other agencies, the Marine Board. I see absolutely no reason why it couldn't stay there, and they agreed to do it in the fiscal that was prepared for this legislative session that reflects a $108,000 savings. Mm-hmm. That fiscal was prepared by Grace's office. Victor Dodier was responsible for preparing it. I think one of the other points that I would like to make is that I resigned from Aeronautics after running the agency for 5 years. I resigned in 1998 in no small measure because I thought that ODOT didn't value aviation, and it was so difficult for me to discharge what I believe were my statutory responsibilities. Most of the changes that Ms. Krunikin detailed when she was speaking to you were changes that occurred after I resigned and began speaking out very forcefully about some of the issues that I thought had stifled aviation within the department. During the time that I sat in the meetings that Grace alluded to, we never got more regularly than 10 minutes to talk about aviation issues. The committee has a new name now. It was called Modes and Regions when I was there. It's my view that 1 month meeting is simply not enough with the Director of Transportation to keep them up to speed on the rapidly changing issues that face aeronautics. And frequently, it's difficult to bring somebody late into a conversation and then expect them to be a full participant in the decision-making. There are some things, I think, Representative Hill, that you asked for that were substantive issues about what would be different. And I know Representative Lehman asked my colleague Chuck Bennett and I the same question when we were in his office. And I want to point out a couple of those to you. It shouldn't have taken nearly a decade to get fuel tax increase bill with any chance of success, like House Bill 2199 that you already heard about. It took 10 years, and I think Mr. Meyerhoff may comment on that, before we take our seats. Aeronautics frequently is not able to speak out on important state, federal, or local issues. Frequently, the wrong people are at the table. It was my experience when I was the manager of the aeronautics section, and I'll give you one graphic example. I spent the better part of 3 hours trying to tell my new boss, who knew nothing about aviation, all of the stuff about aviation so he could go tell it to the ODOT Efficiency Committee. That made no sense to me at all. I knew the material. I'm an expert in the issue.
why shouldn't I have been allowed to go to the meeting and sit there and explain aviation story? But instead, I'm filling an empty vessel so the empty vessel can go and talk to the legislature. I don't think that's good policy. The aviation ought to have a discrete budget. For all the years that I was there, aviation's budget was totally subsumed by ODOT. Our users who were paying the bill couldn't find it. There was no display. It is only in anticipation of this session, and I believe the prospect of this bill, that AERO's budget once again is displayed discreetly. But again, it's a budget that's prepared in a way that is suitable to the Federal Highway Administration, not to our federal funders, who are the FAA. And often when we ask the ODOT major accounting system for reports that our funders need so that they can make sure we're spending federal money correctly, it will take 2 or 3 or 4 weeks to get reports. Our federal funders find that not acceptable, but it's because our budget is prepared consistent with a highway display. We shouldn't have to give more of our budget to assessment for ODOT services than we as AERO make available for airport improvements. The assessment has risen steadily, and it's risen very dramatically. It was $169,000 last biennium. It's $250,000, roughly, for the 99-01 biennium. I think that's wrong, and the people that pay the fees that support this agency think that's wrong, and that's why they support this bill collectively. In my experience, I know of not one person who is aware of this bill in the aviation community who doesn't support it. And it is supported by people like Ken Jernstedt, a decorated military ace, a former legislator, by a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Merrill McPeace, who is a native Oregonian and has returned home. Both the Democratic and Republican caucuses have included this in their transportation packages. Bill Shea, a former director of aviation for the state of California, a port commissioner up in Representative Taylor's district, supports this. The people that pay the bill badly want this bill. And I think with that, in the interest of time, I would be happy to answer any questions, and my colleague, Mr. Meyerhoff, might want
sure.
to speak on
the bill. For the benefit of the committee also, we're going to put it 9:15, by the way. If, in fact, there's more conversation needed on Friday, we won't preclude that whatsoever. I don't want you to feel like we're cutting you off. We are rushing you.
Yes, sir.
But we're not cutting you off. You can talk some more Friday if you feel necessary. And we had a question down this way.
I've got two good questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
9:15, there will be no more. Mr. Meyerhoff will be able to testify.
I'll speak quickly to both of you, since you're both former directors under the current arrangement of ODA. In Mr. Helms' written testimony, he talks about, and you allude to it, Betsy, in your testimony, about the ODOT manager's time as much as, and I quote, attending meetings mandated by ODOT have taken as much as 50% of the manager's time during the past year and a half. And then 2 years ago during the maintenance season, fully 25% of the chief maintenance employee's time was taken up by required ODOT meetings. Why? Why so much time taken up in ODOT meetings?
There are lots, and Mr. Chairman, there are lots and lots of ODOT initiatives that sort of sweep through, and they have brought along the rest of us that are the non-highway part of the House to participate in those meetings. It's interesting that you would raise that point, because I have testified that as much as 50% of my time was used up at the Senate hearing on this issue. The same question was put to Interim Director Ann Crook. She was sitting right next to Director Krenikin. And when asked how much time she now spends, she said as much as 75%. There is a lot of time spent educating ODOT personnel on aviation issues, on trying to bring along people who are ostensibly highway people to understand the nuances of running airports.
Okay. Mr. Meyerhoff, was that your experience also? Spending a lot of time in meetings that were meant to educate people to what aeronautics is all about in aviation?
Chair, Representative Crook, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's continue, Mr. Meyerhoff, if you would. Let's comment, or did you have...
I have a couple more questions.
Well, okay. I'm serious about 9:15. Go ahead.
You also state that in your testimony, Betsy, that one of the benefits of breaking this aviation unit away was that the money that essentially we're spending on it in it's paying for administrative services, which have risen within the state, could be used for educational safety programs, airport capital improvements, improved navigational and weather facilities. Is that a benefit to Oregon pilots, do you think, overall?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, out question.
Okay, and one last question is, in both of your experiences, has the fact that you've been unable to, or in your opinion, has it been your experience, that you were unable to advocate for the agency within ODOT to get ODOT's permission to seek federal funds which could be leveraged 9-to-1 to improve Oregon's airports for safety, for improved transportation? Is that, I'm gathering it by your written testimony, was that both your experiences?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, let me give you an example. Ten years ago, the pilots and the aircraft owners, the people who pay the bill for this agency, this agency is not funded by general funds. It's not funded by general transportation funds. It's not funded by the lottery. This is funded by user fees by pilots and aircraft owners. A decade ago, they identified the need for additional funding for this agency to match 10-to-1, 9-to-1 Federal Aviation Administration funds to provide needed capital because the agency hadn't seen an increase in its budget for many, many years. In 1991, I had the opportunity to bring that issue that has increased before this body. I learned a really important lesson in terms of managing and working with groups of constituents, and we didn't pass it in 91. In 93, we had virtually every constituent that is represented by the aeronautics folks on board with that issue. And we brought it before this body as part of the transportation package. And at the time, the Department of Transportation said, it does not matter to us that you have all of your people on board. It's the entire transportation package or it's nothing. And that's been the case for the last 5 legislative sessions. The constituents have said we agree to a tax increase on ourselves in order that this agency can provide us with the needed services that we want. And that has gone out the window. And if there's one example Representative Hill I could give you, it's probably that more important than anything.
Okay, this will be the final question, and then we'll close the public hearing, Representative Hill.
I guess my concern with that statement is that, you know, there are 90 legislators in this building. Where was the pilot? I mean, we all introduced legislation at the request of our constituents all the time. We do things all the time that agencies don't want us to do, to sit there and to suggest that, you know, the failure of getting a tax increase. And I would venture to guess that you probably would have had a hard time in 93 and 95 and 97 to get a tax increase, even with the support of the user community. That, you know, to sit there and suggest that's the reason why, I don't think is a real reason. I mean, it just doesn't come up to fruition. I mean, have you been told that you have to come up here and sit down and say that you oppose it? I mean, is the governor telling you that? Is it, I mean, who told you that this could not occur?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, if I may answer that question, I was not part of the department when one of the fuel tax bills came forward where ODOT said it's the whole package or nothing. And I met directly with then-Director Forbes, and I met personally with then-OTC Chair Holloran. And I pleaded with them to divide off the aviation portion of a fuel tax package and allow it to proceed through the process and allow it to be split away from the ODOT package. And the answer was no. It is an all-or-nothing package. And where were the pilots? The pilots were lined up to come and testify to that bill. But there was no opportunity for them to come in and advocate for a fuel tax increase on themselves because it was part of a large package that was not moving very well. We believe there was constituent support for the package, the aviation package.
Thank you, Betsy Johnson. We'll close the public hearing on House Senate Bill 108. We will continue the public hearing on this bill.
One other problem with
we will continue the public hearing Friday morning. Representative Hill.
There was just one other problem that I wanted to note that maybe I wanted to get amendments drafted. The way this is crafted, the operative date of the act is July 1st, 2000, except for a section which allows them to appoint the director. However, the board who appoints the director you cannot be appointed until it becomes operative, and therefore you could not appoint the director prior to the operative act of the act, because there isn't anybody there to make the appointment. So there's a little bit of problem in terms of how it's constructed.
Thank you very much for reading the bill. I still appreciate that. Janet, did you have some comments on that? Because that's a very valid comment.
Sure, there was also an amendment to have the governor and the director.
I'll be happy to work.
For the benefit of the committee, we have about four conceptual amendments before us. Now, Representative Hill has brought forward two extremely important issues. The committee understands those. Representative Lavin had two. Representative Lavin, would you mention those two before she gets to this? Your two were? Land use?
Yes, the one that takes them out of the ability to make rules affecting land use, but allowing them as an input in the LCDC here. I gave a copy of that too. I think that was a suggestion of the counties. And we can work on that. The other one was the Representative Hills that we ship out the language regarding that they'd be a pilot. And the third one was that they answer directly to the governor, that the director answer to the governor, not the commission. Those were three we had.
We'll have those before it's Friday. The public will be more than welcome to come and discuss them with us. We're not closing the public hearing. We're shutting it down for today. And we will continue in public hearing. Representative Wilson.
One comment. The dash two amendments, are those part of this consideration?
Dash
are they incorporated? They're part of it. Okay.
Yes, that's the one that was brought forward by Star Northwest. Everybody received a copy of those. We will discuss and discuss those on Friday. Thank you very much. Thank you, audience, for bearing with us. We will now get back on our agenda. We need seven members here before we do anything else. We need to open. Yeah, we have a script before us here.
Mr. Chairman.
Bill, pardon me, committee.
We'll
open
work
session here on House Bill 3090.
Mr. Chairman, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3090.
Thank you. Representative Lehman moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3090. Are there any objections? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 3090.
Representative Lehman moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 3090. Are there any objections? Representative Hill.
Is it that we have the Sixth Amendment and the Script of Purposes?
Yeah.
I want that explained, too.
Yeah.
So now would you please...
House Bill 3090 was the toll road, and apparently the language you pass it out of would have required the study for toll roads on a whole bunch of projects, would have cost a lot of money. We're going to further restrict that back to it's only those that really need to be considered.
Okay. Is the committee comfortable with that? Thank you. Now the bill, which is none, bill is back before the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash two amendments, and if you'll see those at your desk again, those put further restrictions so that ODOT does not have to go out and examine every project over a certain amount, makes it down to the point where they can only look at those that would have some basis for being a total number.
Thank you. Just put the motion on the table. Lehman moves the dash two amendments already to the Senate House Bill 3090, Representative Hill.
These are the first amendments to the bill. One second. Are these replacing the first, the dash one, and replace with the dash two, or is this in addition to the amended?
Chief Chairman, then Bill Beef would replace the previous amendments.
So the motion should be to replace the...
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hill. Appreciate it. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Wilson.
Do you have an idea then of what sort of fiscal impact this cash to amendment would bring? What are we aiming at?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there's about a $20,000 to $25,000 fiscal each time she implements a study. This is going to limit the number of times you're going to actually have to do one of these toll road studies, and give ODOT authority to only do it if it looks like a viable project, rather than having to do it every one that comes up.
All right.
Give them more authority.
The study cost per study remains the same.
Yeah,
what was in the previous one. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Janet Ackman.
I just wanted to point out that there's still the restriction in the current law of which toll projects can be carried out without legislative authorization, and that's not changed by this amendment or the bill. So there's still a restriction.
Thank you. Hearing no objections, that two amendments are now incorporated in House Bill 3090. Representative Layman.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3090 as amended to the floor of the DFAS recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Layman moves House Bill 3090 as amended to the floor of the DFAS. The recommendation, is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Yes, Representative Walker.
Yes, I'm okay with the dash two, but I'm still a no on this bill.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, that's democracy.
I don't like those things.
Well, would the clerk call the roll, please?
How did I vote?
Aye.
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 Aye. Representative Walker.
No.
Representative
Weber.
Yes.
Yeah.
Representative Walker.
Hi. House Bill 39 is passed to the floor of the same carrier that was
filed
to
Philip Brown.
Who was that?
Representative Hill.
Representative Hill. I did carrier. I did not know that, sir. Thank you for volunteering.
Yeah, wait a second. I'm not positive.
I see we have Representative Google on the audience with us. Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Representative Lehman is carrying it. Okay, sorry. Thank you. For the record, Brad, you got it straight down there. Thank you. First bill up will be then House Bill 3303, Representative Ubeloff, and House Bill 3418. 3303, Janet. We will open the hearing on House Bill 3303.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3303, the original bill would have increased the number of disabled veteran registration plates that a disabled veteran could register. And the amendment makes a slight change so that that could only happen if there is more than one disabled veteran that qualifies for the plate in the household. And the reason this makes very much different is this is not just a plate to recognize a veteran and have on the car. It also allows a veteran to have a permanent registration plate, $15 and no additional registration fees that most people pay every other year, the $30 every other year. So this is both an honor and a reduction in cost to the veteran. And that's the dash one amendments are at your place. And Representative Urbaugh is here to explain.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Dingwood. The dash one amendments are yours also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Judy Urbaugh, and I'm the state representative for District 52. Actually, the dash ones came about after I talked to DMV and explained to them what I was trying to do. And they thought, and I agreed, that the way it was drafted by legislative council did not quite get us there. So they drafted the dash ones, and I'm perfectly satisfied with those. Members of the committee, I'm very grateful to be here to talk to you about this bill. This bill actually came about because I can't say a constituent, but this really isn't a constituent of mine, although I think all of Southern Oregon thinks they're my constituents because I get contacted by them frequently. But this gentleman had a very good point, and I would like to share with you just a portion of the letter that he wrote recently, and you have a copy of it, so I won't read the whole thing. But he talks about his spouse and himself are individually both rated disabled. His spouse, his wife, is rated 40% disabled, and he is rated disabled. His spouse is a former member of the U.S. Army Intelligence Corps and was a Gulf War veteran. He is a former U.S. Marine, a Vietnam veteran, and retired U.S. Air Force Master Sergeant. When they went to get their disabled stickers or placards or registration, exactly what you call them, I'm not sure, they were told but the law only allowed one per household. It didn't matter how many disabled people, disabled veterans there were in the household. And sure enough, I checked the law, and that is exactly what it said. It didn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. I think if you're going to give it to one disabled veteran, you should give it to all. And they had two cars. So I had the bill drafted, and that is what you have in front of you, is it would now allow if there are two disabled veterans in the house, they both are recognized and both will be able to get the disabled sticker.
Well, thank you, Representative. When you and I discussed it, I felt the same. I didn't believe and couldn't believe that we would have our law written like that. It's just awful, and I totally support this. I think it's correct.
Right.
Is there any discussion, Representative Walker?
Well, thank you, Representative Verbal. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't even know this was available, and my father-in-law is a disabled World War II veteran. I'm going to alert him to this ability, so thank you.
One of the side benefits of being a legislator.
Yeah.
Representative Hill.
I guess my question is in terms of, you know, many people own more than one vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And would this still only mean that they could register one vehicle under this plan, or is it ensured that if I own two vehicles and I qualify, just only one?
One per person is the answer. Pardon the representative.
No,
I mean, okay. I think it's
the DMV, the connector.
No, that's the whole intent of one per person, and I ask the same question to the representative.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. It's my understanding that the law wasn't written specifically to prevent two people in the same household who were qualified, but it was just the way it was worded that that was the effect of the current language. So,
if there is no objection, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3303, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 3303. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3303.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3303. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Thank you. We have the amendment to 3303. Representative Walker.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3303 with the dash one amendments with a due pass recommendation to the floor.
Thank you. Representative Walker moves House Bill 3303 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Hearing none, 3303 is on the way to the floor. And Representative Rubelaw, would you like to carry the bill? I think the answer is yes, so she's ready for the next one.
I can't. It doesn't matter.
Well, you carry one and Representative Walker carry the other. How's that? Would you like to carry this and Representative Walker?
Oh, I would be honored in honor of my father-in-law and all other veterans that have served in the war.
You can call in about a half hour and tell them the good news. The next bill on the list is House Bill 3418. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3418. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3418, the original bill would have required the Department of Transportation to issue a special program placard for a mental health program. I won't go into that because the Dash 1 amendments don't go that direction. Instead, the Dash 1 amendments increase the amount of time that a person or a vehicle with a program placard can be parked in a disabled parking spot or at a metered place from 30 minutes to 3 hours. A person who has an individual placard can park in a space for an unlimited amount of time. These program placards were designed for a person to just drop off passengers and go park in a place else. The use of that program placard has been a problem, and the 30 minutes has been a problem, and so this bill would address that problem with program placards and increase that time limit from 30 minutes to 3 hours. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, my name is Judy Wardle. I'm the district representative for District 52. This issue was also brought to me by a constituent, a person who worked for mental health services in the public health department of the county. And one of their concerns was many times when they transport mental health patients, they have to stay with them. They aren't the kind of patient that they can drop them off for like a doctor's appointment and leave and come back. They would have to stay with the mental health patient, and this could entail longer than the 30 minutes, and it created some real problems for them. So when the bill was first drafted, I talked about it in those terms, and Legislative Council, I think, did limit it to mental health. However, after again talking with DMV, they have increased the time from 30 minutes to 3 hours for anybody who has a placard, and I think that's sufficient.
Thank you, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Section 2, Subsection 5, lines 4, 5, and 26, where it says, except that any vehicle walking using the placard may park in any parking zone, regardless of length of time parking is where you're going.
That's your amendment?
Yes. Yeah, that's one amendment is what the...
I apologize.
Yeah.
Are there further questions, Dan?
I don't know if Kelly's going to come up or not, but there is an additional change that probably should be made that we didn't catch, that the program placards and individual placards now are not usable in a 30 in a place that's marked for only 30 minutes. For 30 minutes, which is coincidentally the same 30 minutes, but it probably should be added as a restriction in this permit that it isn't good in a 30-minute parking zone. It's good in an hour parking zone.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. Janet's correct. The privileges associated with the placard, if I'm an individual, I can use that placard to park in either zones and time zones without worrying about plugging the meter or worrying about the time zones. Except if a spot is marked for 30 minutes or less, then I'm limited to 30 minutes or less as like anybody else. Program placards were originally only 30 minutes, so their language wasn't in their particular statute. When you move them to being able to park there longer, we need to put that little bit of language back in there so that they're treated like all placards. And that is, if you're in a 30-minute or less spot, it's 30 minutes or less. Mm-hmm. And these people aren't normally parking in that kind of a spot.
As I would understand, what we're talking about is allowing people to park up to 3 hours in cities that have parking meters. That's what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Wells, that's correct.
So, and cities put these meters in to raise money to run their programs and that sort of thing. So what we're doing is with a state law here, so to speak, is we're overriding the city's ability to raise funds, allowing them to park there 3 hours free.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Wells, that's correct. That is current law today for individual placards. This would extend that to those people that transport disabled people. But individual disabled people already have that. That's correct. Today.
Individual disabled people.
In other words, if I'm transporting myself and I have my own placard, that what you're talking about, being able to park in a meter and not pay the meter, happens today. What this is doing is allowing the programs, maybe I'm a shuttle driver and or I'm one of these mental health professionals transporting people to their appointments, it allows me to use the placard that my program has to park there up to 3 hours.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I did talk to Eugene Oregon, the executive director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, yesterday. He could not be here today, and he was in support of the Dash 1 amendment. He wanted me to tell you that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Reverend Logan.
One quick question. Why the distinction between 30-minute limitation and anything over an hour, up to an hour, I suppose, taking part for 3 hours? Why wouldn't be flexible in the 30-minute parking zone as well?
Mr. Chair and Representative Logan, my understanding is that those zones that are like a 15-minute zone or 30-minute zone are fewer and far between, and they're meant to do quick turnover for the business there or wherever they're located.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need that quick turnover there. And at the longer, but at the longer time zones, the cities were willing to forego worrying about the meters or the time zones for the disabled person, so they didn't have to worry about going out and plugging a meter. But these are normally just signs. Sometimes it could be a meter, but it's usually just a signage. That's my understanding of the history behind that. It's been that way for many, many, many years.
Okay, thank
you. Mr. Chair,
one further question.
So who does this apply to? It applies to a driver who is hauling disabled people or people with mental health programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, it's programs that transport disabled persons. It could be a nursing home. It could be a county or public agency. It could be somebody who's got a business, Wheels R Us. It is somebody who's providing transportation services to disabled persons. But they're recognized by a city or county as a business.
Well, as I would understand, the reason we have disabled parking spots is so people can park close so they don't have to walk very far. Help them get there. So now we have a driver who is not disabled. We're allowing him to park there. And he's able to go park somewhere else and walk.
Mr. Chairman, well, that's why the original 30 minutes was there. But more and more what we're seeing and what we're hearing from the program, if my business is to just simply take people to the mall or to a church or something, and I'm sort of like an expanded taxi cab type of service, only I'm doing it for disabled people, I'm going to move on because I've got other clients to go pick up and drop off. So I don't believe that there'll be people just parked there. But there are many programs who not only transport them, but they're their assistive device in and out of the building. They're not just dropping them off to pick them up later. They're taking them to the appointment, or they're taking them to their job skill training, or whatever's going on. So what we've heard is there's a mixed use between programs that transport people. Some simply are dropping off, and in which case, 3 hours, they're not going to stay there because they've got other clients to go get and drop off. And the folks like with Representative Ermolaw's people, they need to go in with the appointment. They can't leave the person at the curb to go move it. So they need a little longer time to deal with them on their appointments. They're doing dual things. They're driving them and helping them in and out of their buildings and at their appointments.
I would add, Representative Wells, as far as the people who contact me concerning the mental health patients, is many of the places they take them to for their appointments insist that the mental health assistants stay with the patient while they're there for the appointment, and that can take some time.
Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
If there's no further questions, we'll close the public hearing. Go ahead,
Reverend. Well, I learned another thing today. I didn't know that with a disabled permit, you didn't have to pay a parking meter fee. So I'm going to tell my father about
it. Your father's lucky now.
He's a lucky man today.
Send her a bill, Representative. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3418. And we'll open the work session on 3418. We have a couple of Representative Hill.
Move it back to the amendment to the House Bill 3418.
Well, thank you, Representative. I believe there was also a conceptual idea put in there, too, of Janica.
Oh.
That feature comfortable with it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, that would be to add a sub D at the end of the bill, parking in zones where parking is permitted only for 30 minutes or less.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves the Dash 1 amendment as conceptually amended. Thank you. Is there any opposition? Hearing none, we have the Dash 1 amendments now in House Bill 3418. Representative Hill?
Move House Bill 3418 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hill moves House Bill 3418 to the floor with the DuPass recommendation. Is there any opposition? Hearing none, 3418 is moving to the floor with Representative Ubalong chairing it. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. The next on our list, we have someone ahead of our way, Brad, the either one of the gentlemen. Which one is that that will be here? Okay, and then we also have Representative 3508 coming in too, I suppose, in about 15 or 20 minutes. Thank you. Maybe we can go ahead and open the public hearing on 3614. Is that the one we're going to hear next? Is Representative Patrick?
Okay.
Okay, and we have Bill Seeley here to testify. I'm just going to drag our feet a minute. Maybe Janet can explain it to us. Thank you. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3614. Janet, would you explain that to us while we're waiting for our representative to get here?
Thank you, Chair. I think I'll start with the background. Under current law, DMV is required to disclose personal information, which would include names and addresses.
Okay, Representative, please come forward. We're just starting to explain your bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
DMV is currently required to disclose personal information, which would include names and addresses from their driver and vehicle records, except in cases, this is disclosing them to a bulk mail distributor, except in cases where a person has indicated on a form that's provided by DMV that they do not want their name and address disclosed. House Bill 3614 would in effect reverse this process and require DMV to withhold the information from bulk mail distributors, except in cases where the person has indicated on the form that they do want their name and address disclosed. Bulk mail distributors are defined as distributors of surveys, marketing materials, and solicitations. I did want to point out to you that I'm going to talk about, we just got it this morning, about this vote on House Bill 3614, and it is a substantial reduction in revenue to the department because of the sale of the list. And I think Sophie from the Department of Transportation can explain that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for having me this morning. I apologize that I was late. We just voted out the BOLI budget. I'm here today on the, just for the record, State Representative Rob Passage, House District 50. I represent predominantly the city of Medford. I'm here in regards to House Bill 3614. The reason we brought this bill to the committee was concern by some individuals about how much bulk mail and other things that they continue to get. I believe over 250 people buy these bulk mail lists from the state of Oregon, and they are distributed throughout the state. And also the concern over the public policy of releasing public records. I think it's incumbent upon the state as much as possible, I believe, to keep individuals' information for the individual, except when the individual wants that release, other than certain public records exceptions. I've also talked to Representative Ross and Representative Bowman, both of which who were involved in a substantial change in regards to the public disclosure of records during the last legislative session about this, and won't speak on their behalf, but neither one of them raised objections when we talked about this, and Representative Ross told me she'd come testify. I wanted her to coordinate that. I don't see her here. At the time.
Mr. Chair, I also worked on that for information, worked on that.
Thank you. Representative Logan and myself and Wells were on the committee that had this thing last
year. And Representative Wells suggested the ones who suggested that I talked about that. And I talked with both of you yesterday. What this does is now it is an opt-out procedure whereby someone can opt out if they don't want their records released. What this does is change it to an opt-in provision saying, where you affirmatively say, I want my records released. I think it's a good public policy. The DMV things that we fill out oftentimes get filled out quickly, and there's many questions on the form. I think that this is a better protection of public policy and a less cost, and a better protection of your individual information. I'd be open for any questions.
Thank you. Pardon me, Reverend Hill. We have two people signed up to testify for the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where usually I'm consistent, and then I oppose these changes in terms of access to public information, in terms of driving is not a right privilege, and therefore becomes government information in terms of the changes that were made in terms of which protected people who have used it. In terms of, to me, we sort of adopted a perverse approach to it where individual citizens couldn't gain access to the information, but if you had the $150 to pay for the tape or whatever the cost was from DMV and you wanted to go mail them a solicitation for anything you could, and you could get all the information. This, I think, is probably the best approach in terms of preventing to not disclose information as regards to licensure, and that, and yes, it will have a profound effect on mailers, and I'm sure, I would assume somebody at some point will surface and realize what this does and squeal long and hard about how it will be devastating to your ability to conduct mail order businesses and access information in terms of from insurance companies and those types of things. But I think in terms of this is the better approach to managing information, is that if we're going to give the information out, even though the restrictions will still be there, the individual still wouldn't get
be able to access information even if someone opted in to the program. This is a far better approach to the problem. But it's a slippery slope, and the next thing that'll be next, that you can go down to the voters register and get all the same information that you wanted on someone, where they live. You probably can get better information there, and as elected officials, we all know what the impact of that would be if those suddenly didn't become public records. So be careful what you wish for. You just might get it.
Thank you. Bill Feeling. Thanks for being here, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Feeling with the Driver Motor Vehicle Services Division of ODOT. I don't have an awful lot to tell you. It really is simply a question of public policy on how you want the records used. Right now, we do offer the opt-out option. We have slightly in excess of 50% of people who do business with DMV that have opted that out. We're in a mode right now in this biennium and departing to the next one of a more aggressive opt-out. You directed last session was in part by House Bill 2096. So we're right in the middle of that. But this bill would do, we would basically reverse what we're up to now and offer people an opportunity to opt in. If this were to pass on the effective date of the bill, everyone would be considered opt-out, and we would move into a mode of giving people that opportunity, and as people opt in, it's the rate of opt-in that would determine whether DMV would even be in the business anymore providing these lists. If it's low enough, then I doubt that anyone would see us as a viable source of this information. Based on what we've heard from our customers over the years, we have complaints from people who don't like us doing this practice. We don't have anyone telling us that they really want us to, but that may be because we do. But our opinion on it at this point is that we probably would not see many people opting in.
Thank you, Representative Wells and Representative Taylor.
Thank you. You charge for those lists, don't you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, yes, we do.
So what kind of fiscal impact would there be on your department and loss of revenue versus the expenses to do so?
Representative Wells, we passed out a fiscal impact.
Yeah.
For the top of that, I apologize.
Yeah, you want to let me know?
Here it is. Okay, he has.
I don't know.
Okay.
Here you go.
And then I had one here I lost.
Would you like to review that? And I'll go to Representative Taylor.
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seeley, the opportunity to opt out now is offered at the time your records are renewed, your driver's license is renewed. Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, yes, that's correct. Applications for original driver licenses or vehicle titles, plus very expensive with the time of renewal for either of those.
And so it's been only since 1997 that 50% have chosen that option to not be included on the list.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor,
since that bill was passed in the 97 legislative session.
Representative Taylor, actually, the first time this was on the book was introduced by Senator Glenn Otto in 1989. We've had it around since 1989. We made that offer, but it was what we were doing is primarily doing that at the time of an original issuance of something. We weren't putting a lot of effort into it at renewal time. Renewals are one of our, we try to keep that very efficient, keep the response time low, and make sure that from the renewal monies that we're giving as much of that money to the highway fund as possible. And it was the last session, really, that we were asked to be more aggressive at renewal time, and that aggression has increased the number of opt-outs.
Go ahead,
thank you.
Hey, yeah, we'll hear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I Representative Patridge, I sort of think that it's working pretty good, given those figures. What we have now is working pretty good, and that to turn it around could cause some confusion, some expense at the agency. I don't particularly care about the loss of revenue for selling the names, but to completely reverse what we have done in the past, I actually think there's probably some people who don't care, and so they won't opt in, but they didn't opt out, you know? So we may be at the level already where we're going to be, almost.
Representative Taylor, what I would say is that I don't think that, based upon some of the calls that I've gotten after we introduced this legislation that ran in the press, that people were glad to have that because some of them didn't realize they had the option to opt out. And they have specific pieces of paper and things like that. But if you're like me, I try to go to the DMV as little as possible. Not that they don't do a good job, but I try and go there as little as possible. And I think that and that's why we offered this up, is because I don't think that a lot of people are aware of those things. I think if I ask most people, I don't think that they want their addresses sold. And if they want to, they have the opportunity to opt in. But otherwise, opt out. And this, I believe, in the long run, would probably save some time and Facebook entry if you look at their fiscal recommendation. Basically, on the assumption that only 2% of customers could choose to include their personal information, you know, I believe in the long run, instead of trying to have the computer work it so it opts out, you have an opt-in, so you're doing only 2% of the work instead of 98% of the work for people to opt out in the long run as this thing plays itself out, based upon what's going on. So I realize that it's a reversal of policy, but I also think it may save some time in the long run for people who don't want their information disclosed.
Thank you very much. We have Ted Drew signed up to testify, too. Any further questions?
I have one more. Mr. Chair, how low? Right now, you basically can only get out about 50% of the names because 50% of people have opted out. Is that what I'm reading? Well, how low a percentage can we go and still have a viable program where you're selling lists? Or do I have the wrong information?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Wells, you have the right information. I think by the time we finish being aggressive around the opt-out, we're guessing that somewhere between 75 and 85% of people would opt out. That's a pure guess on our part.
Seems like, in essence, they've already killed the program. If I call up DMV and want to list all the people who have RVs and 75% of the people have already opted out, that doesn't look like a very viable list.
At the the 50% option, we haven't seen much change in the number of these records lists that are provided annually. I agree there is a point where the list is not viable. I don't know what that point is. And even at 10 or 15%, depending on the business you have, it may always be viable. The information is fairly cheap compared to the cost of mailing and all of that. So these people are in business, and if it makes good business sense for them to spend several hundred dollars to get a list from us, you're going to do it. But you're right, there's a point where it just isn't viable anymore. I don't know where that is.
Thank you very much, Bill. Next on the list is Ted Hughes. Ted, did you want to jump on?
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ted Hughes, today representing the R.L. Polk Company from headquartered in Detroit, Michigan. R.L. Polk is the principal contractor with the motor car companies for recall. And as such, they are very, very concerned about access to motor vehicle records. They have contracts with the Department of Motor Vehicles around the country to facilitate the recall. And as such, last session we sat, as you all know, in the huge task force that was created to deal with access to records. I've never seen a larger task force in my life. We met maybe 12 times, including legislators, including Representative Loken, Senator Montgomery, a lot of the banks, the auto dealers, the newspaper publishers, the broadcasters, all came, amazingly, to a consensus on access to records. This was the last session. It was quite an undertaking. DMV has done a fantastic job in implementing that bill. You'll not find me very often supporting DMV, but I've got to give them a good attaboy for their efforts on instituting that bill. They were involved in the task forces, and they have made it work. I guess if there's a change necessary, opt out to opt in. We'd like to, it appears to R.L. Polk that this bill was a beautifully constructed bill and is being implemented the way all the organizations intended. And we'd like to see it stay in place and see if it works. We don't think a change is necessary.
Yes, Director Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're reading this bill as how it impacts R.L. Polk's ability to get lists for the purposes of recall?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hill, I do. The more people that opt in, the less names there are.
But in terms of, isn't there specific rules related to the access to data for the purpose that you're talking about? What this bill is dealing with is selling the list for commercial use, in terms of which is different than what you're talking about, where R.L. Polk would still be able to get full access to the DMV list for the purposes of obtaining information for vehicle recall. But if they were to get the list for the purposes of reselling it to sell newspaper subscriptions or magazine subscriptions, they would not be able to. So my understanding is, in the present law, you're protected in terms of the ability to get the information for vehicle recall. This is dealing with the list that is generated that would be available for commercial. Someone, I want to come in and sell widgets to everybody in Oregon. I buy this list and I can then mail to them. It's two different issues.
Mr. Chairman, that's true. It's R.L. Polk's fear of how this bill would be implemented. They're comfortable with the existing system. The law that was passed last session works. And like anything, they're skeptical and worried about change.
Fair enough. One more question, then we'll move on. Representative Wilson?
Thank you. A change like this, I believe, I might be wrong, would impact some small businesses who were concerned as we were going through this workflow process that they have some access and they get it through companies like CIS, I guess, and Pulse, and they reach customers or their business through advertising. So there is where I have a concern, and the fact that we did work hard to bring about a good process. I know you change processes as they go along, and question, but I have to give a little more consideration to this before I'm ready to be a yes.
Yes, thank you, Representative Hill.
Mr. Chair, I'm ready to move forward with the bank. This is the better approach to address the issue. We're not in the business of maintaining mailing lists for commercial companies. They have other avenues in which they can go out and accumulate the list of names in terms of to generate for their mailing list. There's a whole market out there. I participated in it and worked in that area. There's plenty of places that they can go and purchase the names necessary to contact people for their subscription. I don't think it's necessary for the state to operate a mailing list service for commercial enterprises.
Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3614. I'm looking up and down, and I don't know if I have a constitutional problem on this bill or not, but we're going to find out the hard way or the easy way. I'll open the work session on House Bill 3614. There will be minimal discussion. The pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Gaston Amendment. We have any?
Representative Hill moves to pass an amendment.
Do we have it?
Yeah.
Director Hill, thank you.
Staff one amendments.
There is.
I don't have any amendments.
I was going to say I got it. I wanted to not have any.
Did these dice on amendments get discussed?
We're in the half one. That's the
one. Oh, yeah. We're
We did not discuss these bachelor amendments. We don't have time to discuss them now. We have another bill before. Unless the committee wants to move ahead, looking at them momentarily, we'll take 30 seconds to look at them if you'd like to move them, and then we'll go ahead and move.
They're moved.
The bill moves the bachelor amendments to 3614. If the committee feels comfortable in voting yes, that's fine. The clerk will call the roll when he gets back to his cat watch.
Mr. Chair? Discussion.
Yes,
I believe that we should leave our present. I will be a no because I think we have to give a little more time to our present situation. And,
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no on this bill. Also, I think that we need to have these lists available for the and there's so I'm a no on this bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about the fiscal impact, losing that much money from the highway fund, but I hate both now. I'm going to be a yes on this.
Just briefly, in terms of the loss of revenue is only because of the cost recovery system, so if we don't do it, we don't lose anything else. It's not revenue lost to the roads, and it's just revenue lost to the cost to produce the list. It's not a profit center.
Okay, we have before the committee the Bashford Amendment to 3614 as moved by Representative Hill. Now, if you call the roll, please.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Wilkie.
No.
Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
No.
Representative Montgomery.
I'll be aye, but probably more on the floor. Thank you very much. On the amendment, I'm aye. How we have before us, House Bill 3614 is amended. Representative Hill moves that.
So moved.
House Bill 3614 is amended. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk call a roll, please.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Representative Taylor.
No.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
No.
Representative Montgomery.
Montgomery votes aye, reserving the floor vote. Thank you. House Bill 3614 has amended moves to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Representative Hill, would you carry the bill?
I would be more than happy to.
Thank you. Representative Hill carries the bill. Thank you, Representative. Thank you. The next bill we have up is House Bill 3508. Do we have Representative Butler headed our way? Then we may not hear Representative Butler's bill today. We all have very important things to do, but the most important thing is still that you introduce, and if you can't find time to come and testify on your bill, the committee should not spend a lot of time on it. As a courtesy, Janet, can we schedule this maybe for Friday morning, or what would the committee like to do?
Mr. Chair, sounds pretty straightforward to me. It's a request of pilot corporation. They're willing to pay the cost of the installation of the signal. Sounds like a safety issue. I don't have a problem with it, unless ODOT does.
Well, I have a lot of conversation we need to have. I think we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3614. Janet, could you explain it to us, and then we'll have to come forward and talk to us, since she's patiently been waiting here.
3508.
3508. Thank you for keeping me straight. House Bill 3508. We open the public hearing on it. Janet, briefly discuss what they want us to do.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3508 would require the Department of Transportation to install a traffic signal at a specific intersection in Ontario and require that the cost be paid by the Pirate Corporation. Mr. Chair, I want to point out there is a fiscal impact statement, although the department would not be paying for the signal, but the department would pay for maintenance and operation of the signal, and that's what the fiscal statement is.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for waiting us out. So you would come back on Friday. Maybe we could hear from you today. Thanks for being here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think as Janet stated, the bill would require us to install a signal at the cost of the petitioner. We're assuming that it also assumes the necessary road improvements that go with the signal would be borne by the cost of the petitioner. Simply installing the signal, however, does not provide an acceptable long-term solution without other local road improvements. We've done a traffic study, and there are some necessary improvements needed to the local street system to arrive at an acceptable solution. We are willing to work collaboratively with the city and with the private landowners in the vicinity to develop a workable plan to improve the situation in the long term. The bill does circumvent traffic analysis and planning for future development, and by earmarking a traffic signal at this specific location.
Thank you, Tom. Are there questions of the committee? I guess my one question, has the City of Ontario been involved in this along with your cooperation, and are they in agreement with ODOT's position on this light?
Mr. Chairman, we have worked with the city, and we have some correspondence from them that recognizes this need for local improvements in addition to the mere installation of the signal.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you have been working with Ontario, were they in favor of ODOT's position of delaying this subject to your planning process, or were they in favor of installing the signal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loken, I don't think I can adequately speak for the city, but I do believe they recognize that the signal in and of itself creates congestion problems and that the situation needs to be addressed, but there are local improvements and the signal that need to be brought together. So I believe they are in agreement to work collaboratively for a joint solution as opposed to just merely installing the signal.
Thank you. We do have Representative Butler with us now. If you'd like to come forward, maybe you can.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question.
Oh, yes, please.
So, is this a safety issue? We've been having a lot of accidents at this particular place. Is that partly the reason you think they're asking for this?
Chairman Montgomery, Representative Krepp. I believe so. I believe there's troublesome maneuvers as trucks attempt to get into the pilot station, and so the activity is not what we want. And again, just to say one more time, we do have trouble with merely installing a signal and assuming that will solve the problem. It is, there's more to it.
Thank you, Tom. You'll be around for more. Well, Griffin's later.
Sure. If we put this signal, I mean, if we go in and as a legislative body plant a signal, what does that do to properties around that area? Does this change them in terms of usage? Or value or things like that, or is this going to have any impact on that area where the signal is going in?
Chair Montgomery, Representative Lehman, I believe it does. I believe we have signals that are too close to each other, that we have some backing up through the signals, that there needs to be improvements to the local system. So we have pretty detailed analysis, but there would be impacts. So I think in simple terms, we might fix one problem and cause others.
Is this signal going to affect the development of property around there? Is it going to enhance the ability of properties to develop that around there if we're able to put this signal in, or is it going to detract from that?
Again, Chair Montgomery and Representative, I'd have to get you that answer. I'm not sure with the impact on development. I know our analysis looked at the future development as part of the overall impacts of putting the signal there. I think there's some large commercial development intended in it zoned that way.
For the benefit of the committee, I plan to adjourn at 10:30. If we don't get done, again, we can carry this over to a Friday also for a work session, if necessary. Is that correct? We have any time on? Okay. So let's let the representative come forward, and then Tom, you'll stick around with us. Yes, thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Butler. I'm from Ontario, Oregon. I have a conflict of interest with regard to House Bill 3508, a direct conflict of interest. The instance...
Could you give more details on that?
Yeah.
I'm associated with Pilot Corporation. And this bill is at the request of the Pilot Corporation. And I do own properties in the vicinity and directly involved with and around this particular site in all four quadrants of the freeway. I will state that right up front that there are traffic control signals every two blocks with the exception of this particular area, and it goes for a series of about four blocks where there is no traffic control signal, and this would be about the halfway point between the existing signals. The instant issue deals with a concern over the safety and the prior years before the State Highway Commission expended approximately $8 million for a safety improvement project in this particular area. There have been, I understand, about 20 accidents in a period of 1 mile. In the last 4 months, I am told by the regional director that there have been four accidents in the past 4 months in this particular one spot, which we spent $8 million to identify a safety issue and have created a much worse situation out of it. The has been testified they're concerned about, that ODOT is concerned about traffic backing up into other traffic control signals, and presently the closest traffic control signal is about 2.5 blocks one way and 2.5, or yeah, about 2.5 blocks the other way, and then on into the rest of the city there every two blocks at a particular point. There's been some, and without going into any great detail, there's been some very severe setback of all of the accesses to the property, and ODOT's first option in this regard, and it will be their final option if the traffic problems persist, is to cut off access to all of the properties involved for as many as two blocks, and potentially up to five blocks of accesses will be totally eliminated. Destroying probably a third of the job base for the downtown core of the city of, or, of this portion of Ontario, including Rida Foods. As been indicated, the ODOT has done a study and has indicated that they have estimated huge future development of this property. They've done so with a great deal of fallacy. They've indicated this is commercial property. This is not commercial property. This is zoned industrial property. The only way that this property, a portion of it, could develop out is if Orida Foods, the largest single employer in the area, were to close up its doors, at which point there'd be no reason to put any traffic control signal there. We just go ahead and roll up the sidewalk and it would all go away. We've also discussed the potential of asking ODOT to please comply with some of the original agreements that they had with the folks that have developed there, and they have been somewhat less than willing to comply with, and as a matter of fact have made a brand new arrangement to, I think it's called the March 1999 draft for controlling traffic along Idaho Avenue in Ontario. So with House Bill 3508, I come before you, again expressing my direct conflict of interest relative to this particular bill, and expressing that this is not a bill which will cost the state any money. The people involved have paid much more than their share of the cost, have provided land at no cost to the state to provide some of the other accoutrements to try and benefit the state in the process, and it's been made into a much less safe situation. And the only other alternative is that the state is now going to start cutting off and eliminating accesses and eliminating jobs to companies
on the entryway into Ontario.
Thank you very much. I've got time for a couple questions, and I have to leave, but I can, the committee can go on if they want to. Everything well.
Representative Butler, this is evidently the main street through Ontario.
This is Highway 30, and it is the main street into Ontario, Idaho Avenue.
The alternatives, if they cut off access, is there any way to put an access road in? Is there enough frontage to put access roads in so we can channel down to where the lights are? Is there any way to solve that problem?
Our family has dedicated and has given land to the state and the city of Ontario and have done that. It has been unsuccessful because they did not come forward with the agreed-upon traffic control signal that was agreed upon 13 years ago.
Chair, follow up on that. If they run an access road through there down to where there is a signal to get access, I'm still at a loss where what it, of course, without seeing it, I suppose it's hard for us to understand the situation, but when you limit access onto a main road, of course, the other way, the other thing you can do is put an access road in and channel it down to where there is access, and evidently that hasn't been an option here.
It's about 2.5 blocks away, the access road, and what it would have to do, Representative Wells, is that it would have to be a circuitous route to get access to and from the stop or the traffic control signals into and out of the existing developments. And so you're absolutely right. The problem is that we've got a access road that's just a dead-end access road. The traffic control signal would provide the access to the access road.
Okay, if there's no further questions, I'm not going into work session on this because we have to get with Tom some more, and it's past 10:15 right now, so we can try to put it up for Friday. We have 5 bills here for Friday. We decided we're going to start at 8 o'clock and move forward. We got started at 8:20 today. I appreciate you being here on time so we can get forward. I don't want to cut anybody short. We will hear Senate Bill 108 Friday morning and try to file through the other bills as we can. We will have some disappointed people in getting to their bill, but that's the best we can do. I would like you to get done with these Senate bills and let the other committees work while we enjoy watching them work. At this point, we will adjourn until Friday morning at 8 o'clock. And we'll do-